The American Melody Hour, usually presented at this time by the makers of Bayer's Aspirin, will not be broadcast tonight due to the special program which follows immediately. From the Grand Ballroom of the Hotel Waldorf Astoria in New York City, Columbia brings you the opening of the fourth and final session of the 16th Annual New York Herald Tribune Forum, whose theme this year is Modern Man, Slave or Sovereign. The speakers are Secretary of State George C. Marshall, head of the United States delegation to the General Assembly of the United Nations, who will speak on the reconstruction of Europe, and Hector McNeil, British Minister of State and head of the British delegation to the General Assembly of the UN, whose topic is Britain's role. The speakers will be introduced by Mrs. Ogden Reed, president of the New York Herald Tribune. Mrs. Reed.
This country, generally, did not realize the great step forward of General Marshall's speech at Harvard University on June 5th. Both England and France were faster in reaction, and the true significance of his words lit a heartwarming fire throughout Europe. They were a torch that brought light to people's eyes and new hope to many souls. In retrospect, we now know that it was probably the most important public document since the pronouncement of the Monroe Doctrine more than a century ago. The man who will open this final session has already done more to unify the people of America in their understanding of other people's problems than anyone else possibly could. In his selfless leadership, he transcends party lines. He is apart from politics. He belongs to the nation. I have the honor of presenting to you our beloved Secretary of State, George C. Marshall.
Ladies and gentlemen, the discussion this evening, as you well know, is directed to the problem of the reconstruction of Europe. For many months, both the government and the people of the United States have been considering the growing dangers of the economic situation in Europe and our relation to the problem. That Europe's need of assistance is real and urgent, I believe, is no longer a matter of argument. And it is likewise evident that the United States of America, in the present state of the world, represents the primary source from which this need can be met. I have endeavored on a number of occasions to make clear why, in the view of this government, it is in the basic interest of the United States to do what it can, within reason, to meet these needs. I am sure that you all understand the vital importance to us of the preservation of European civilization. We cannot stand indifferent to the fate of the nations who are having great difficulty in recovering from the consequences of the war and are looking to us for assistance. These are people who hold the same views of the international conduct as we do. If we are to be successful in our quest for peace in a decent world, we will be constantly in need of their strong cooperation. When I made a public statement at Harvard on June 5th last, to quote from a more recent statement of mine, it was plainly evident that a situation had developed where we must immediately choose between two lines of action, either to concern ourselves solely with our own internal affairs, despite our heavy commitments in Germany, Austria, and Italy, while Europe suffered a complete political and economic demoralization, or we must take action to assist Europe in avoiding a disastrous disintegration with tragic consequences for the world. Therefore, the suggestion was made that the European countries, under the pressure of the dilemma which faced them, should join together in working out a mutual basis of cooperation for their own rehabilitation, and should determine, on a businesslike basis, the degree and character of the outside assistance they calculated would be urgently needed over and above what was humanly possible for them to accomplish for themselves. Our government has realized from the first the magnitude of this problem and the numerous pitfalls that lie in the way of its solution. Despite the urgency of the situation, sufficient time had to be allowed for the collection of all pertinent facts and opinions, and a thorough study of all the elements, both foreign and domestic, which enter into the problem. We have the preliminary report of the 16 nations who met in Paris this summer. We are beginning to receive reports from the various governmental groups who have been examining into our own resources and their relationship to possible demands of the European situation. Commissions of Congress, who have traveled extensively throughout Europe, are returning to this country, and the results of their investigations are becoming available. I think it is important that you should understand something of the procedure which is now being followed by your government in arriving at a conclusion and preparing a program for presentation to the committees of Congress and later to the Congress itself. At the present time, in fact, every day of the week, including Saturdays and Sundays, a large portion of the personnel of the State Department and representative groups of other interested departments and agencies, such as the Treasury Department, the Departments of Commerce and Labor, the Departments of Agriculture and the Interior, for example, are engaged in daily sessions, working together on data which I have described, to determine exactly what should be the program of this government. I want to repeat the latter part of that sentence. They are engaged in daily sessions, working together on data which I have described, to determine exactly what should be the program of this government. I do not believe any project of our government has ever received more careful study and preparation than has this problem of the reconstruction of Europe. And I am certain that no governmental effort has ever enjoyed such complete cooperation on the part of all the agencies concerned. When it is completed, it will truly be a program of the United States government and not of any one department or agency. Your contribution should be of great value, in bringing the people, the public opinion of the country, to the support of this great effort. There has been constant reference to a Marshall Plan. The reference to me personally was unfortunate, but the reference to a plan was definitely misleading. There was no plan. There was a suggestion. Now, we're in the process of drafting a plan as a proposal to the Congress of the United States. That is the situation at the moment. The period of study and preparation is thus drawing to a close. The time of action is at hand. Thank you.
The forum is fortunate in having a spokesman for the United Kingdom on the program, the British Minister of State, now at the United Nations. The British Empire is also blessed in the fact that this Scotsman went into politics instead of becoming a shipwright like his father and grandfather before him. Because one of his hands was not strong enough for shipbuilding, the father decided regretfully that his son would have to depend on his head for a living. It was a history-making decision. The story goes that when at the age of 10 the boy won an argument with his teacher, she said despairingly, "You ought to be in the House of Commons." 20 years later, after a short but successful detour in journalism, the young debater was making his first speech in Parliament. Within a few more years, he'd become the youngest Privy Councillor of the United Kingdom and second in command at the British Foreign Office. More than any other minister in the present government, he's had to answer extempore adjournment debates. This skill has stood him in good stead at the United Nations, where he is a match for both wit and brains on the part of others. Because he is theoretically at this moment presiding at a dinner in honor of Dr. Ebbett, Australia's Minister of State for External Affairs, he will have to leave us immediately after his speech. We're therefore especially thankful to have him here for a brief time, and I know how glad you will be to hear the address of this distinguished Scot, the Honorable Hector McNeill.
Mrs. Reed, despite your extravagant and not very accurate praise, it is a great pleasure to be here and a very great honor to speak on the same platform and program as your Secretary of State, Mr. Marshall. When Mr. Marshall spoke at Harvard on June 5th, he did nothing less than challenge the nations of Europe. He said that whatever help the United States could give, the initiative must come from our continent. 16 countries of Europe have taken up that challenge. Invited by Bishop Bido and by my chief, Mr. Ernest Bevin, they met in Paris in the middle of July, and by the end of September, the report of their deliberations was ready for publication. Their report, I say immodestly, is a remarkable document. It will repay the closest study. To assess properly the value and the significance of the report, it is essential to appreciate the background. The scale of devastation and dislocation caused by the Second World War was more intensive and more extensive than the damage of the First World War. Whole cities, great industrial areas, many ports, complete transportation systems were smashed by the ingenuity and the valor of American, British, and Allied airmen, and by the panicky fears of the retreating enemies. As a result, the industrial production of Europe was reduced, I dare say, to a lower level than it had known for 75 years. The damage doesn't end there. The soil of Western Europe bled white for a period by its Nazi occupiers, has been starved for 7 or 8 years almost of all fertilizer. Its productivity is desperately reduced. Moreover, skilled agricultural labor has been scattered in all directions from the Baltic to the Mediterranean. Agricultural machinery, overworked and destroyed, has not been replaced. Consequently, the gross total of food produced in Western Europe today is lower now than it was in 1938 because of the misfortunes and the devastation visited upon that area. To these native deficiencies must be added also these disturbing facts. Eastern Europe no longer exports food on the pre-war scale, and Western Germany, for example, as a result, is forced now to turn to the Western Hemisphere to avoid starvation. Southeast Asia, too, used to send fats to Europe and rice to India. But once more, because of the Japanese invasion, Europe must try to replace these fats, and India to replace that rice again by buying from the Western Hemisphere. Now I concede at once that it is peculiarly a miracle of this century that the United States and Canada and the other countries of the American continent have transported these mountains of food and raw materials to meet the hungers of Europe and Asia, and partially to restart their smashed and broken economies. But this flow of food and of raw materials and equipment from west to east across the Atlantic has to be matched by either a flow of dollars in return or by a supply of goods which the American continent wants. No one knows that better than the people of my country and of Europe. But Europe has just emerged from disaster, and they have to spend much of their effort now and in the last 2 years rebuilding their factories, their roads, their bridges, their railways, their canals, their shipyards, and their homes. Their natural commercial production has therefore been greatly retarded. Consequently, the United Kingdom and nearly every country of Western Europe has had to draw upon their gold and their dollars to meet these deficiencies. It is proper that we should remember here the great assistance already provided by the United States, by Canada, and by other countries, including my own, who through UNRWA and other international devices made great contributions in the emergency period. Despite this, however, the exchange reserves of Europe have been and are still being steadily drained away. Their needs for food and for raw materials are still high. The dollars left are perilously few. Here is the essential root of the dollar problem. No one can explain it away in other terms. As the world recovers, this problem will right itself. Europe will not always need these goods in these quantities, and by the development of her exports, she will once more earn the dollars she needs to buy food and raw material from the American continent. But meantime, there is this gap, this deficiency, this barrier. I must, however, say that anyone who pictures Europe limping along, hand outstretched for dollar charity, wrongs Europe badly and wickedly. Europe, up to last winter, had made remarkable strides in recovery. I can offer relevant figures from my own country, which are dramatic. Like my friend and colleague, Miss Jenny Lee, whom you're going to hear tonight, I come from Clydeside. I therefore know about shipbuilding. In 1938, taking no account of repairs or reconversions, we were building in Britain 780,000 tons. In July of this year, we had under construction 1,877,000 tons of shipping, more than half the total tonnage building in the entire world. Not luxury shipping, like the Queen Mary and the Queen Elizabeth, quite built, in which I exult. Not luxury shipping, but tankers, freighters, coasters, barges, the vessels for which the world waits efficiently to move its food and its produce. Let me give you a few more figures. In this year, as compared with 1938, we are building 75% more trucks, fabricating 55% more rayon yarn, processing 26% more steel, generating 45% more coal gas, and 67% more electricity than we did in that year. There are industries where the figures are not quite so impressive, but in these industries, in reorganization and reconstruction is already taking place. Make no mistake about it, none at all, Britain and Europe is on the move. Our people are aware of their obligations, and that is broadly true of all Western Europe. But the pace of our recovery has been retarded by forces outside our control. The frost of last winter and the heat and drought of last summer struck Western Europe so badly, so sharply, that there is no parallel, at least in my lifetime. The whole economy of Western Europe has again been slowed down. Many countries have had to cut their imports of essential foods and raw materials. They are living from hand to mouth, scarcely able to budget for a month ahead. That was the situation when Mr. Marshall made his arresting Harvard speech. And I regret to report that the situation has deteriorated since that day. This, then, is the background against which the statesmen and the economists of 16 Western European countries had to measure their efforts when they responded to the challenge made by Mr. Marshall. Their target was to put Europe economically on its feet by the end of 1951. As everyone will appreciate, this production effort is a gigantic one. It is, and I measure my words, on a similar scale to that launched by the United States in the mobilization years of 1940-44. The recovery plan calls for the increase of coal by one-third, steel by nearly two-thirds, electricity by 40% above the 1947 figure. This is to be done by European nations alone. In such an extension, a great burden is quite properly placed upon the United Kingdom. Our coal progress, it is planned, should be expanded from almost 200 million tons this year to almost 250 million tons in 1951. This is an ambitious program, but everyone can be assured that my government and the people of Great Britain will spare no effort to overtake it. Now, I wish I could tell you that our troubles were ended. It's not so. Despite this determination to cooperate, the participating countries in the immediate future will still require large quantities of food, fuel, raw materials, which can only come, broadly speaking, from the American continent. They are not extravagant requirements, believe me. None of these countries are sitting back waiting for American charity. Even when in 1951, as I confidently believe, the European economy will be almost solvent, there will be less food, less clothing, less gasoline, less comfort in many of these countries than when their people in 1939 took on the fight against fascism. This isn't another relief program, though I will never be ungrateful for the relief which I saw flow to Europe. But it is not relief. This is an investment in Europe. It is a recovery program. The proposals are a statement of the production effort that the European peoples consider after calculation they themselves can achieve, provided they make the maximum use of their own resources, and provided, above all, that they do receive certain scheduled, scrupulously estimated capital equipment, foodstuffs, and raw materials from overseas without having to pay dollars for them. They don't ask for charity. They have not the dollars for which to pay. It's difficult for me to be unemotional upon this subject. Europe is in a pronounced downward spiral. Should it continue, the consequences for Europe and for the world to which Europe reaches out are incalculable. Statisticians tell us how many will starve and perish before the next harvest is won. Economists can tell us how many people will be idle and empty of hope because materials are lacking to keep the factories of Europe going. But the political, the social, the family stresses that hunger and unemployment cause have never been and never will be calculated by statisticians and economists. You may put on a register the figures that you cannot on a register put the men, the women, the children, their hopes, their fears, and their anxieties. And no Christian should ever attempt to do so.
Columbia has brought you a special broadcast in connection with the fourth and final session of the 16th annual New York Herald Tribune Forum. The speakers were Secretary of State George C. Marshall, head of the United States delegation to the General Assembly of the United Nations, and Hector McNeil, British Minister of State, who heads the British delegation to the General Assembly of the United Nations. The speakers were introduced by Mrs. Ogden Reed, President of the New York Herald Tribune. This program has come to you from CBS Public Affairs. The American Melody Hour, presented by the makers of Bayer's Aspirin, was not broadcast tonight due to the special program which you've just heard. Tune in for the American Melody Hour at the regularly scheduled time next Wednesday. This is CBS, the Columbia Broadcasting System.